Mini episode 558 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to mini episode number 558 of the FDH Lounge. Rick Morris with you here today. I have two original FDH Lounge dignitaries that will be joining me. Jason Jones, Chris Galloway. Jason Jones, also, of course, our senior editor and in charge of our NFL draft coverage. Our face of the company, as it were, for NFL draft coverage as well as NBA draft coverage. He may not like the comparison when I say essentially the Mel Kiper of the franchise or the Mike Mayock of the franchise. And he would probably say I'm not starting us off on a very good note by making those comparisons. But we'll see what he's got to say. Jason, good to have you in, my man. How you doing today?
Repulsed by the Mel Kiper line, but endeared by the Mayock line. So, take
okay.
What we can get.
Well, just using it as an analogy, in that you are in charge of our draft coverage, the rankings, etc. And again, for good or for ill, it is Mel Kiper that people come to think of first and foremost in this industry. So, a logical point of comparison. I see also that we have on our third FDH Lounge original dignitary, Chris Galloway, joining us. This has been an annual tradition. Come on, talk draft, both preview and recap. Good to have you on for the preview today, Christopher. Any opening thoughts on this year's NFL draft?
I think it's going to be exciting. I think there's going to be a lot of movement.
I do as well. And maybe that's one of the places that we should look to start. Jason, I know that, of course, with our NFL draft guide, Pro Football Draftology 2015, you are writing extensively on the subject of Marcus Mariota, who looks like he is going to cause, I think, some of the instability in the draft this year as far as the lack of predictability ahead of time on how things are going to shake out. It's thought that he could go with the second pick. Before all this started, he was thought to be the first pick overall. He has been supplanted in that by Jameis Winston, who is, I think most would say, the superior physical talent, and that appears to be what's taking over at this point in time. You and I have talked about this off-air, Jason, in that a year ago, Teddy Bridgewater was a real victim of silly season. This year, I think it's more so been a fact of people going back in and looking and finding legitimate flaws in Mariota's game, trying to project him from a spread offense to the pro game, and saying, hey, wait a minute, and I know that's a lot of where you're coming from on this, is not finding a lot of pro projectability in what you've seen thus far.
It's just not as exciting if you've got one guy at the top of the hill and another guy who's supposed to be the next best option is much, much farther down the hill.
Chris, your thoughts on Mariota, and I know that, as you well know, I'm not a guy who's big on renouncing my own opinions, but that is a subject where I have sort of taken a step backwards. I know that in the case of our Cleveland Browns, I had been an advocate throughout the season of the Browns possibly being in position to get him, and I'm no longer willing to say that should be the case based on some of the questionable natures of how his game looks to project. As Jason has pointed out, in his article about the ability to fit the ball in a tight window that seems to be unproven at this point. What are your thoughts on Mariota? Because he seems like one of the bigger X factors this year.
I think if you're any team other than the Eagles, there is no reason to mortgage the future or to you know, lose a lot of draft picks, at least in even this year, or to gamble on a guy like Marcus Mariota who doesn't necessarily project that. I think there's too many question marks, and like the Cleveland Browns, I think they would be crazy to give up multiple draft picks on a guy that doesn't fit. You know, you and I have had a conversation many times about some guys just fit some systems, and their careers would have been better if they were another team. And I think Mariota steps right into the Eagles to have early success. And he could even have long-term success as long as he's running Chip Kelly's system. But, you know, you put him on the Browns, you put him on, you know, the Tennessee Titans, I think he's going to struggle. And he could struggle for several years.
I would really agree with that. I think that's an excellent way to describe him at this point as being a system quarterback. And, Jason, it's kind of a long fall, isn't it, from where he was coming into the draft, quite possibly the presumptive number one pick, the Heisman Trophy winner, to now being thought of in many quarters, including these ones apparently, as being a system quarterback.
Well, yeah, the first thing that comes to mind is I think we got to stop putting a lot of stock in Heisman Trophy winners. But putting that aside, look, the fact of the matter is that Winston's the number one guy, and it's not even close. He is natural. It's almost instinctive, like a great point guard. With Mariota, I can't remember a single time that he threw the ball deep into tight coverage. He's not a great passer. He's great at hitting guys that are wide open. He's great on his feet. But, yeah, it seems to me he's absolutely – and I don't want to pin the guy and say there's no way he'll be anything other than this, but from where we sit – viewing prospects, NFL prospects, he looks like someone who's great in a very intricate system. And if, as Chris mentioned, if you put him in just your typical pro-style NFL offense, he's going to be like any other rookie. It's going to take him 2 or 3 years before he even gets there. And once he gets there, it's my opinion, which we'll see if it's proven out or not, it's my opinion that he's going to be Alex Smith, maybe a little bit better on his feet, but he'll be a game manager. He'll be good but not great. And he definitely won't be worth what it's going to take teams to move up to get him.
I think the Alex Smith comparison is a very, very intriguing one. And as you and I have discussed off air, even right down to being part of a system in college with a coach that doesn't necessarily translate to the NFL, that is a very interesting point of comparison. In terms of the top quarterback in the draft, and in all likelihood the top pick in the draft, Chris, this notion of Jameis Winston going number one, which appears to be cemented at this point, and on the surface you can see why, because if he works out, he's the kind of franchise player that Tampa Bay needs. But I just have to wonder about this, coming off of the year after Johnny Manziel and some of the other things in the NFL with Adrian Peterson, Ray Rice, teams talking about how they're going to be taking these things more into account in the future. There are very, very few high-profile players in recent years that have come into the league with more red flags off the field than Jameis Winston. Is this an instance of short memory, given everything that we saw last year off the field in the NFL?
I think human beings have a tendency to look at the attributes that they like. You know, men do it with women. Oh, she's really beautiful. Ignore all the vanity and the selfishness. And I think GMs do the same thing. I think Jameis Winston, you know, scored well on the Wonderlic. He has all the physical tools. He can make all the throws. I mean, you look at him physically and you say, that's a guy who, you know, should be a star quarterback in this league for, you know, 15, 16 years, except for the fact that off the field he's immature and potentially even, you know, had engaged in criminal activity on multiple occasions at times, you know, in his young life. You know, minor, well, I'm not going to get into the rape allegations, but, you know, the BB gun incident, the crab legs, and it comes back to judgment. And if this guy's going to be the face of your franchise, you know, you are really rolling the dice with him. Frankly, if I was a GM, he's not even on my board. I just take him off and that's it. And I do the same thing with Randy Gregory out of Nebraska. I mean, in Gregory's case, I mean, I just think he's an idiot. I mean, I'm sorry. And these are red flags for Winston, Gregory, and some other guys that, you know, history has shown us again and again and again, whether it's Josh Gordon, is that they may have all the talent in the world, but they never stop being a knucklehead. And if I was a GM, that's the first place I would start. Okay, you're a knucklehead, you're not on my board. You don't exist.
Well, Jason, I could tell from the laugh there that the analogy was hitting home, this notion of perhaps Jameis Winston as Lindsay Lohan, NFL GMs, as a guy saying, hey, I'd hit that. So thoughts on the analogy, Jason, in terms of Jameis Winston being the hot chick who may not be worth the problems?
Well, I definitely don't want to come off like it's not an issue, because it is. And it's something that absolutely needs to be taken into account if you're that GM, especially if you're the GM of a team like the Bucks, who, you know, aren't exactly in a great position, probably need a handful of good solid picks this year just to get to respectability, because last year was pretty awful. So you do need to consider it. I will say that I think there's a big difference between Jameis Winston and Randy Gregory. If Randy Gregory fell to the 30s, I don't think anybody would be surprised at all. Because what Randy Gregory does is premeditatedly stupid. Now, I don't know who listening has any experience with these sorts of issues, but when you're going to essentially a job interview that's going to pay you a vast amount more than anybody else you're probably ever going to know in your life away from that industry, you gotta tighten it up. So that's a big one. The thing is that, and Chris used the word, it's knucklehead stuff. It's Winston is stupid immaturity garbage, but I have a sense that that's all it is. And I don't think this is going to be 5 years from now, he still can't keep himself clean because it's knucklehead stuff. So I hope that there's a maturity that's going to come. It's still a risk. Here's the catch, though. When you look at Jameis Winston, and anybody that didn't watch a lot of him in college, just go back and watch the workout that he gave at the combine, which is something you don't normally see. There's no other way to say it. It's natural. He just has an ability to make the right throw with the right touch at the right angles. It's you don't see it a lot. And I'm gonna throw something out that's gonna really upset some people. But hear me out. Jameis Winston is the anti-Andrew Luck. And what I mean by that is, on the field, they all make the throws. They both have velocity, touch. They can do everything you want from a franchise quarterback. The difference is there's no one in the front office at Indianapolis that's losing any sleep at night because for fear of a phone call at 3 in the morning about Andrew Luck. That's not going to happen. Now, there's a very real possibility it could with Jameis Winston, so you just have to ask yourself, is it worth the risk to have arguably a top five quarterback 5 years from now who's the face of your franchise and really, really taking you places? Or, as Chris alluded to, is it just not worth it and you'd rather let somebody else deal with that stress? And that's the question the Bucks have. And I think based on what they need and what's available and what people will give up, I think they're forced into a corner. I think they have to take Winston, and I think they've already made that decision.
It's not an easy position to be in, and when we're talking about gifted athletes at the skill positions here, one of the next ones I think it's logical to get into would be at the running back position, Todd Gurley. I was joking with somebody the other day that he is the highest-ranking running back to come out since, well, probably Trent Richardson. But, again, a prototype, a big bruising back with a lot of speed. And something that I know, Chris, you've been picking up on being in the Cleveland area, much like myself, the notion of him going to the Browns on a lot of drafts, which I don't know if that would be the most Browns thing to do ever when they already have Mack and Viner 2K15 and a bunch of holes elsewhere. But thoughts on what having a guy like Todd Gurley out there, about how that can apparently turn some brains to mush when people start projecting what he can do for you?
Well, you use the Browns as an example. Yeah, they have two solid young running backs that are complementary, but Gurley is far away more talented than anything the Browns have on the roster. And when you have either a young quarterback or no quarterback, and you are a team like the Browns that want to run the football and run it effectively, a guy like Todd Gurley, who seems to have the best package since Adrian Peterson in terms of skill and ability, he very easily projects to a top five running back in the NFL day one. And everything's healthy, I think for sure. So if you're the Browns at 12 and he's there, it is seriously tempting if he's the top guy on your board to go and take him. Now, if I was the Browns and Gurley is there and somebody like Devontae Parker is there, I go with Parker because that's a far bigger glaring need at the moment. But you do have two decent young running backs that are serviceable. And let's be honest, behind that line, Rick, you know, even on Sundays, you'd look pretty good.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, my lateral moves back and forth. All I got to say is the number one thing I can talk about with that is getting juked out of my tennis shoes back in college playing a little bit of football in the parking lot by a guy that had double knee surgeries wearing boat shoes. That's about all you need to say about my ability to cover anybody. So a bad moment, but very representative. Jason, thoughts on this? Who do you tend more to agree with on this? Because it sounds like Chris is a little bit more, you know, open to taking Gurley. That, to me, with the Browns' copious needs that are out there, I get the greatness of him, and I think he's better than Crowell, who is the Browns' lead back at the moment. I get all of that, but as far as what you do, yeah, it is hard to pass on a guy with this kind of talent and upside, and it looks like he's going to be fully recovered from the knee injury. But this is almost a classic example right there, the encapsulation of really need versus ultimate upside.
Yeah, let me just start by saying there's only a few guys that this happens to, and he's one of them, that the first time I see him, my reaction is absolute, I'm over the moon. And my next question is, when is he draft eligible? So he was in that Adrian Peterson class for me. So to sit back, and if we were going to talk about the Browns specifically, to sit back and watch the draft last year and then the signing of Crowell after the fact and then to see how they worked together, there was a part of me in the middle of the season last year that kind of died thinking, well, there goes Gurley. Because the question you have to ask yourself, it's not – who's better? It's not Crowell versus Gurley. It's what you have from Crowell and West compared to what you have at, say, wide receiver or defensive line or whatever it is the glaring need you want to look at. Because to me, if we take Chris's example, you pass on Gurley, but you get Parker, then Parker plus Crowell plus West is still better than Crowell, West, and Gurley, and nobody to throw to. So for me, as much as I love Gurley and as much as I'm positive that he's going to be up there in that Adrian Peterson beast mode sort of conversation where he is a three-down back, you just give him the ball, let him go, and I have no concerns about his injury history. All things being equal, I think Gurley's a top-five pick, but things aren't all equal. So in this case, although I agree with Chris's enthusiasm for how good he's going to be, I still kind of side more on Rick's side for that. I'm not saying it has to be need versus best available. It needs to be best available within the need that you have. And if Parker's there, oh, God forbid, if Kevin White is still there, you take that best wide receiver. Now, if three or four wide receivers go off the board in the first 10 picks, then we got to revisit this whole situation. But Gurley's going to be a beast, and sometimes you have to walk away from that.
Excellent kind of King Solomon there between Chris's and my point of view, and I agree with you. None of these things happen in a vacuum, and it's all about taking him plus whoever else is on your roster at these other positions. And, again, you guys have both referenced the wide receiver class. Certainly wanted to get into the top positions on this because wide receiver, defensive tackle are those two. Let's stay with the skill positions at the moment. This draft, Chris, again, I don't know that on paper it's going to stack up to last year's, which I think it's the one we've been waiting for. It's I think the second coming of the class of 96, although it could. If enough of these guys work out, this class could possibly be right there with last year's, and that would really be something to have two historic crops in back-to-back seasons. I know that with Jason, there's been a little bit of thought on Cooper and what he may have in terms of upside versus some of the other guys. Where do you come down on this, Chris, as far as the top couple guys here and how they can define this draft class?
Well, I think this draft class is going to be just as good as last year's. And I don't think, and I just, you know, I want you to know, I think that this is going to become more and more common. Because I think the systems that guys are running in high school now and in college are being so wide receiver focused, passing game oriented, that these wide receivers, guys are the most talented guys on teams now are moving into wide receiver positions. And I think you're going to see in the next 10 years better and better wide receiver classes. So I don't think this is, you know,
I don't know what next year will be, but I think there's a trend where you're going to have deeper and deeper wide receiver classes than you've had in a long time. As far as this year goes, you know, I think we know what Cooper is, and he's going to go in the top 10, and somebody's going to pick him up just like the Bears, and it won't, you know, they won't miss on that. I mean, he's going to be a solid asset for a team. But I think Parker and White actually have their upside. And, you know, I'm excited, you know, for the standpoint that they could be available to grab somebody like Parker at 12. So, you know, I think they're all pretty close. I mean, if one of those wide receivers will fall to Brown, I think they need to take him. To Jason's point, if they're all off the board and Gurley's still on the board, then the Browns probably need to go in that direction.
That will be a very interesting conundrum. There's a lot of mock drafts that have them going in that direction. A guy whose name is not generally coupled with the last couple of ones mentioned, almost exclusively because of off-the-field issues, because he's been pretty great between the lines when we've gotten a chance to see him, Doriel Green Beckham, of course, from Oklahoma. And Rob Rang on CBS Sports, Jason, made an interesting point and said, hey, bear with me, but the last name seems to be kind of apropos because he reminds me a little bit of A.J. Green and he reminds me a little bit of Odell Beckham, which I thought was interesting. But in terms of how these guys shake out, you've had the opinion for a while that Cooper is not the slam dunk number one pick, as perhaps it seemed he was going to be coming into the offseason here. He would be the first wide out off the board. That pick is becoming a little more mainstream. You were kind of ahead of your time on this, but what are your thoughts on this year's class and if Chris is right and it can be as great as last year's was?
Well, the class as a whole, I think we have to really look at last year and stop being enamored that it was so good. And it was. But it was unconventional good. Because to be fair, Mike Evans was the only guy in last year's class that you look at physically as a prospect and go, size, speed, ability, he looks like a prototypical number one. And the fact of the matter is that Odell Beckham and Sammy Watkins don't look like typical prototype number ones. However, production-wise, you got to think that they may be just that. So in this case, I think it's a little apples and oranges, but I think in this year's class, as opposed to last year's class, you've got 8 to 10 guys that prospect-wise project out as being number ones, which is impressive. I think the overall depth of last year might trump it a little bit. But as the class in general, Chris may be onto something, that this is a trend maybe, because this draft class looks just as impressive as last, but in a different way. Now, we'll get to some names, but as far as Amari Cooper, there's one of these in every single draft. There's one guy that because he plays on a high-profile program and you've seen him on highlights or whatever, you're just automatically going to default to, oh, he's the guy. He's just the guy. My concern is that when you step back from it and start viewing these guys as prospects and not college players, you start to find some things that maybe aren't a concern, but are the kind of thing that makes you step back from clear-cut number one. Amari Cooper is adequately sized. He is adequately fast. He's not game-breaker fast, but he's game fast. My problem with him is he feels like a possession receiver. The other big problem is he catches with his arms entirely too much. And if you're a GM or a scout, you got to look at that and go, I don't know about this. And for anybody who's following up on the Browns sidebars here, this is Braylon Edwards all over again. The thing with catching with his arms is a horrifying red flag. So is he going to be good? Absolutely he's going to be good. Is he top five worthy? Good God, no. To me, when you look at this draft class, you've got guys like Kevin White who have size and speed, catch with their hands, they're game-changer type guys. Parker's up there. You could even make the argument that if used properly, maybe even a guy like Devin Smith could get into that conversation. Doriel Green Beckham, Brashard Perriman from UCF. They all have, like, breakout ability, home run hitters, the kind of guys that keep defensive coordinators up at night. I just don't see Amari Cooper that way. I see Amari Cooper as being sort of like 8 years in Larry Fitzgerald. He catches everything, but he's not scaring anybody. So is that worth the number one spot at that position? For me, it's not. And for me, I'm going to be much more intrigued with a Kevin White or a Devontae Parker. But the draft class is going to be solid, no question about it.
It is going to be, no question about it. And, again, what's very interesting to me is it's a very, very deep class, and yet there continue to be more guys continuing to work their way into the conversation here. Aguilar from USC is rising up the board quickly in a lot of places. What are your thoughts on him?
Yeah, he's a guy I really liked. And just from a projection standpoint, I thought if he could fall to the top of the second, somebody's scoring major. Because he's – now, here's the thing. Aguilar and Amari Cooper are not that different ability-wise. So the question is, let's say you're Oakland, do you spend the number four overall pick on a guy like that, or do you potentially trade back in around 25, maybe, and try to get Aguilar, who's very, very similar? But he's absolutely flying up the board. I've seen most recently as high as 15th overall. So Aguilar's no joke, and that's just another example. Once you get to him, you know, you're going to start to find some of these other guys, the Dorsett kid from Miami. There's a lot of good players in here that bring a different sort of thing. Now, Aguilar is not the home run hitter that some of these other guys are, but he's absolutely worth being in the conversation for first round consideration.
No question about it. In terms of time constraints here, let's kind of combine a little bit defensively, because I know we wanted to talk defensive tackles outside of wide receiver. That might be the best position on the board this year, but again, the pass rushers are very fascinating as well, both at OLB and defensive end. So, Chris, thoughts on some of the top guys here? We talked a little bit about Gregory earlier and some of the red flags surrounding him, but you've got Leonard Williams, who was thought to be a very rare talent, who, were it not for Winston, would be a candidate to go first overall and may perhaps have gone first in some past years. The year that Eric Fisher went first overall certainly springs to mind. So, thoughts on some of the guys in the trenches and then some of the pass rushers as well who could be game changers for teams.
He is just a beast, and he is going to dominate in the trenches in that tackle position. I mean, he's a guy that the Bucs really ought to think about drafting number one. You look at some guys like Danny Shelton. I know a lot of people are really high on him, and he's got great feet, and he's big, and he's powerful. I worry about his weight. I worry about his condition long term. And I also think, he's a two-gap run defender. I'm really high on Malcolm Brown out of Texas because I think he can do more. I think move him, 3-4, 4-3. I think he's a little more versatile. I also think he's really smart, and I think that's helpful. Like I said earlier, Randy Gregory's not even on my board. If I'm a GM. But there's a lot of defensive backs and there's a lot of talent out there to be had for a GM, especially, those two rounds.
No question about it. And an interesting point that Chris raised, Jason, is players out there, you got to think there's a little bit more value attached to them when they're not as system-dependent. Certainly Malcolm Brown, as he cited, at Texas, you could picture him in either a 3-4 or a 4-3, and you can't say that about everybody, that's for sure. So thoughts on some of the dominators, both in the trenches and coming off the edges defensively in the draft this year?
Well, I've had a Haloti Ngata love affair with Danny Shelton since probably about November. Yeah, those that have been with us the entire time will remember me banging the table for Haloti Ngata years ago.
Yes.
But I really like Danny Shelton. And because of the comparison, you're going to get this position eligibility, flexibility situation where you say, well, look, he can play nose, he can play the three technique, whatever, which is why I like him. Even if your team switches from a 3-4 to a 4-3, he still works. Eric Armstead, totally different deal. He looks like a freak physically. He's ridiculously large, more height than weight, but and really does kind of play more like a defensive end in a defensive tackle's body. I like him a lot. I do like Malcolm Brown. But as far as the interior defensive lineman, for me, it's really Danny Shelton and everybody else. I would almost say I would rather have Brown over Armstead, and that has nothing to do with scheme. Just I like the player better. As far as on the outside, though, this is a really sexy pass rusher draft. And I say that as it's causing me problems because we keep hearing about Bud Dupree flying up the board, almost getting into that top 10 range. And the scary thing here is, and I don't know if you guys are getting this vibe, but the whole Bud Dupree thing, and when any highlights you see of him, aside from just sitting down and watching a game, the highlights remind me so much of Barkevious Mingo. The guy was projected to go middle to late first round, then all of a sudden he's flying up the board, and then you watch him and you go, yeah, but he's not overpowering guys, he's not faster than guys, but he makes plays in the field. Okay. So my concern there is that we're having a Barkevious Mingo thing, but Fowler, Leonard Williams, if you want to go there and consider him playing, you know, the three technique in a 3-4 is nice. Vic Beasley is a guy who's not getting talked about right now, and that's a huge concern because I don't know. Right now, it's a flip of the coin between him and Shane Ray to me, and that may depend on scheme. But the pass rushers are probably the sexy part of this draft, and I would not be surprised if you see 5, 6, even 7 guys go in the first 20 picks. It's that impressive. So if your team has a need at that position, and I think collectively the three of us definitely have an interest in pass rusher, you're going to have to take care of that quickly because if you don't, you're going to be staring at the top or the middle of the second round with not the same prospects you were hoping for. So defensive end, outside linebacker, 3-4-4-3 doesn't really matter. There are players to be had there. And defensive tackle may actually be the most intriguing at the top with those 3 to 4 defensive tackles that are going to go in the first round or at least the first 35 picks. But, of course, my favorite being Danny Shelton and Vic Beasley.
There is some incredible talent in there, no question about it. And as you said with the pass rushers, yeah, it does start to get more fallow in round two. It's not as deep as some positions like wide receiver where you can maybe wait a little bit longer and still get somebody there. Want to ask you guys a macro-level question, as we often like doing on the show here, because there was a tweet that I came across from NFL Network's Ian Rappaport, and there's two ways to take this. One is that either you can look at it and say, we're through the looking glass now, or you could look at it and say, well, teams are just taking into account the full range of what value constitutes. Ian Rappaport tweeted, and I'm paraphrasing here, he is hearing increasingly from teams this year that when they're figuring out what a player is worth, they're looking at a lot of mock drafts out there. So, Jason, who knows? Maybe there's some eyeballs on yours and mine, optimistically. But regardless, there is this thought that teams are taking that into account. To me, that actually makes perfect sense, because if you're seeing a lot of the same names in the same places everywhere, that sort of indicates what the market value is. And Chris, I know you're a guy with some real philosophies on market value, whether it be in football economics or anything else. I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on teams taking this kind of chatter into account?
I think a team that is basing their value analysis on a player based on mock drafts, I think that's a GM in the scouting department that ought to be terminated immediately.
Do you think it's godless for teams to do that?
That's an owner who should march down and say, I don't need all of you guys because I can buy all the magazines and I can look at FBH and I can use their analysis and I can just talk to Jason on the phone and go ahead and make these picks myself. If this is how we are determining value on these players.
Okay, so is it a gutless thing in your estimation of where teams are looking at this and figuring, hey, we can't possibly be hit for taking this guy even if he fails because everybody else said he should go here. Do you think that's a component of it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I'll use, you know, because they're my team, I'll use the Browns as a great example. You know, everybody just dogs the Browns for their draft picks, you know, since 99. But how often have the Browns actually made a draft pick that the supposed experts come out and say they're out of their minds, that pick? Let's go back, you know, look at Courtney Brown. You know, everybody said this guy is going to be all-world, all-pro. He's dominant. He's everything, you know. And they picked him, and everybody cheered. Great pick by the Browns. Last year, everybody had Gilbert as the first or second best cornerback in the draft. They pick him. And so, let me tell you, I don't know. Maybe the answer is the Browns have been doing this since 99. I don't know. Maybe they've been grabbing the Sporting News mock draft, and that's what they've been going off since 99. So, you know, I go through the Browns draft for years and say, other than a few ones that were obviously horrible, like Big Money or, you know, William Green, you know, most people applauded their picks and, you know, the supposed experts. So when they, you know, when I see those same experts on the TV or on radio preparing for this draft saying, boy, you know, the Browns just can't get a draft right, I'm like, yeah, that includes all of you.
Well, that seems like a good way to bring this full circle. Jason, your thoughts on teams out there potentially listening to monkeys like us and what we're saying ahead of time?
For every single team except the one in Western Pennsylvania, by all means, you can get my phone number, and I would be more than happy to play GM for you if you'd like. This has been a nice, fun thing, and everyone's been agreeing for the most part, and I'm going to play a little devil's advocate on this one. For every Courtney Brown, there is a Sean Thompson, Willie Green, Tim Couch, and people can say that Tim Couch was a pick that people wanted, but it was also a pick where every analyst said, this guy drew up plays in the dirt. So take that for what it is. But I think if you go down the list for every single Courtney Brown example, or even Gerard Warren, where people said, yes, that's the guy you take, I think there are 2 to 3 picks that you just go, what are you doing? And here's where I'll bring it together. If there are GMs out there that are sort of checking the wires, so to speak, looking to see where mock drafters are putting people, I would say use that as a tool in Congress with everything else. If you're looking at it as a form of identifying market value, then maybe there's something to it. Because the problem is when a team like the Browns goes and picks Barkevious Mingo and everyone's real excited because, like, oh, he's a nice player. Yeah, but look at what it was 2 days ago. He wasn't supposed to go that high. You were trying to be more clever than everybody else, and the only way you can adequately do that is be reincarnated as Bill Belichick or find a way to gauge market value. And if you've got 100,000 people who say Todd Gurley deserves to go in the top 10, then don't sit there and try to wait on him in the 20s thinking you're going to get him. Now, do I think it should replace scouting? Absolutely not. And if that's the case, yes, go with Chris's way and march that owner down the hall and get him the heck off of your premises, because that's ridiculous. But if you're doing all the scouting and all the prospecting and all this work, and you're also consulting the internet to see where the consensus is on market value, I don't think that's a bad thing. I just don't think that you should weight it very high.
I actually kind of agree with that, Ed, because, again, like you said, maybe it can be a little bit of a check against doing something like the Sean Thompson picks, the Barkevious Mingo picks, where the rest of the world will look at you like you got a hole in your head, because sometimes the rest of the world is right about that. And unfortunately, every time I, as a Browns fan, have shrieked about something like that, I've been right, which is actually a curse. But kind of a depressing note to bring this full circle on. But as always, a grade-A conversation with you guys about the NFL draft. This has been one of the greatest traditions in the FPH Lounge to do this. Looking forward to reconvening afterwards and seeing what everybody thought. Chris Galloway, Jason Jones, many thanks to you fellas. Appreciate it for a great conversation, guys.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Always a pleasure.
Excellent. Thank you both. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today for FPH Lounge mini-episode number 558.
we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.